You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. People convicted of murder as juveniles in Michigan have a chance to get out of prison because of that U.S. Supreme Court decision that said the law that required a mandatory life sentence for them with no chance at parole was cruel and unusual punishment. This prompted Michigan courts to begin resentencing some of its so-called juvenile lifers. With the second largest number in the nation, there are hundreds of cases to review. A few of these juvenile lifers have been released, but most of the remaining prisoners are awaiting their court date, knowing they could just be sentenced to die in prison again. Morgan Springer from Interlochen Public Radio has the story of one of these men.
Jose Burgos was 16 years old when he shot and killed Omar Khaji. It was the early 90s in southwest Detroit. It was the result of a bogus drug deal.
The whole plan was, you know, we're going to get this bag and we're going to make it look like, you know, from the outside looking in, it looks like there's, you know, 10 pounds of marijuana in this bag.
Jose and three other teens stuffed a bag with rags, hoping the twin Khaji brothers would hand over $17,000 without inspecting the bag. Jose and his people drove to the meetup spot. Jose put a gun in the bag of fake marijuana. Then he went into the twins' car.
And I got in the back seat. And as soon as I got in the back seat, the driver,
that was Omar Khaji,
had turned around and reached back and grabbed the bag that I had put right next to me.
Jose says he quickly told Omar, "Hold on, let me show you the marijuana first."
It was at that moment that I realized, what could I just get myself into? I don't even know what to do here.
Jose says he had never fired a gun before, but he saw Omar moving around, and though he couldn't see what he was doing, he thought he might be reaching for a gun.
From then on, it was just like everything happened just like so fast. And that's when I reached in, I put my weapon out, I held it up. It was like adrenaline had taken over me, and that's when I fired the first shot.
Jose shot both the twins, grabbed their money, and ran to the getaway car. In the car, he took out the wad of cash.
There was a $20 bill on top of the stack. There was a $20 bill in the bottom of the stack.
But in between those two 20s was nothing but paper. In an attempt to dupe each other with paper money and rags, Omar Khaji was dead, his twin Ayman Khaji was paralyzed, and Jose was sentenced to die in prison.
Do you know when that was taken?
This was, I don't know, this one.
In her apartment in southwest Detroit, Jose's sister is looking at old family photographs.
That's my mom and him. That was a very old picture. Polaroid.
Jose's sister's name is Maricela Burgos, but no one calls her that.
I say like this, this is my thing. Who's calling me by my government name?
Instead, she goes by Prieta.
Prieta, that means dark. That's been my name since I was a child.
Now she's a single mother living in a second floor apartment with her four kids. Next to the house is a vacant lot where her landlord plants vegetables. Next to that is a collapsed house. In the front is a freeway. And she works at a grocery store nearby. Jose and his siblings came to the U.S. mainland from Puerto Rico when Jose was around 5 years old. Their grandmother raised them in southwest Detroit. They didn't know their dad, but their mother lived nearby with her boyfriend and was a big part of their lives.
Lourdes Maria Martinez.
That was their mom's name.
My mom was like the one that brought everyone together.
She was like the life of the party. She was very energetic.
After my mom passed away, everything changed.
She passed away in 1988. Jose was 13, Prieta 11. They say their mom and her boyfriend had always gotten along well, but then the boyfriend accused their mom of cheating on him and he hit her for the first time. Their mom came to their grandparents' house, and when no one was looking, she swallowed most of their grandfather's heart medication. They rushed her to the hospital almost immediately, but 3 days later she died, and it was ruled a suicide.
And, you know, it crushed me, like, what do you mean? You know, like, what about us? Where do we stand? You know, we're your kids, we love you.
At the hospital, the doctor took them to see their mom.
She had tubes coming out of her from everywhere, and she was just laying there. And everybody was just surrounding her, the gurney. And one by one, they were reaching over and they were kissing her on the forehead. And so when I came up, I stretched myself up, I kissed her on the forehead, and that was the last time I seen her there.
And after that, it was just all hell for all of us.
I can look back now, and when I take an honest inventory of my life, I can understand and recognize that this is where, like, things just started going bad.
That fall, 13-year-old Jose entered junior high and almost immediately started skipping school, smoking marijuana, drinking, and hanging out with the gang, the Latin Counts. The grandmother tried to stop him and make him go to school, but he wouldn't listen. 4 years later, at 17, Jose sat in court awaiting his sentence for shooting the Kaji brothers. He says he remembers it vividly, like the moment the Kaji's mother made her statement.
That's when she held up the picture. It was a picture of her with her two sons, and they were by her grave. And
Jose says it was the grave of the twins' father. The Kajis had immigrated to the U.S. after their father's death, and the Kaji mother told the court she brought her children to this country for a better life, and Jose had taken that away from them.
The mother's statement really has always stayed with me, you know. It's something that I've carried all of these years.
When it stays as it stays with you, what do you think about it?
You know, it's almost like my life and their life, it mirrors one another. You know, when I think about the families, you know, you have these two different families come from two different countries. They come here looking for a better life. And the one common thing that one of the main common things that we have with one another is the fact that, you know, we each lost a parent. And here we are, we end up somehow, you know, meeting up with one another. We both have these intentions in our minds, you know, in this deal. And it's just, you know, that's just something that's always stayed with me. It's like, you know, how does something like that happen, you know?
When Justice Clarice Jobe sentenced Jose to life without parole, that was the mandatory requirement for all juveniles convicted of first-degree murder. Justice Jobe took issue with that at Jose's sentencing when she said, quote, "I find the limitations of this statute to be totally unfair to everyone concerned. However, I have to live with them and deal with them, so looking at all of it, I don't think I have a choice," end quote. But this is exactly what changed after the U.S. Supreme Court ruling 5 years ago. Because the court said the mandatory sentence Justice Jobes had to give was cruel and unusual punishment, judges can now choose anywhere from 25 years to life when sentencing these juveniles. Now they're able to choose a sentence based on that specific juvenile in front of them, looking at things like their upbringing and the circumstances of the crime. And for people like Jose, who already got mandatory life and will be resentenced, the court will also consider their behavior in prison, asking, does Jose fit the legal description, irreparably corrupt? In other words, is he irredeemable, and does he pose a threat to society? Or has he been rehabilitated, and does he deserve a second chance? These days, Jose is incarcerated at a correctional facility east of Flint. He's 42 years old, and he's been in prison for 26 years. He's a mentor for kids in trouble with the law, and he's a prisoner observation aide. That's someone who helps monitor prisoners who are suicidal.
We have a seat. We sit right in front of the cell. They give us a document to make sure that we document every 15 minutes exactly what the prisoner is doing. If the prisoner is laying in bed, you have to write down the prisoner's laying in bed. If the prisoner is talking to the prisoner observation aide, you have to write that down.
Jose says some suicidal prisoners don't want to talk, and so he'll sit there and observe and make sure they don't hurt themselves. But other prisoners will talk.
You know, if they tell me they have parents or any siblings, I explain to them, you know, they love you, and there's a better way, you know, to deal with whatever it is you're dealing with. You know, life is beautiful, and, you know, it's going to be okay. You know, no matter what it is you're going through now, you're going to have hard times in life, but it's going to be okay.
This is Jose's life coming full circle.
Every time I'm watching one of these kids, I always think about my mom, and because I think about, you know, what could drive a person to want to hurt themselves. You know, I never knew what exactly drove my mother to do what she did and how and what took her to that dark place where she felt that this is the only way out of the situation.
Jose's file is thick with certificates of achievement, his GED, classes, work, mentorships, and in the past 20 years of his incarceration, he's had very few infractions. But Wayne County prosecutors do not think Jose is rehabilitated. They did not want to comment on Jose's case in an interview, but in the motion they filed last year, they said, quote, "Defendant's crime in the current case was not the result of unfortunate yet transient immaturity, but rather evinced irreparable corruption that requires a life without parole sentence," end quote. Prieta doesn't think irreparable corruption describes her brother.
He wouldn't have tried to get in, you know, into this mentor thing and doing good things in there. He would have chose the wrong path if he was really that bad of a person, if he was such an animal. My brother made a bad choice, the wrong choice, and he's paid for it.
The prosecutor doesn't decide Jose's new sentence. A judge or jury will do that. But this recommendation does not help Jose's chances of getting out. Of Michigan's more than 350 juvenile lifers, prosecutors say 60% are irredeemable and should stay in prison for life without parole. That's according to MLive. This has surprised some, because the U.S. Supreme Court said this should only happen in the rarest circumstances, where the juvenile is considered irreparably corrupt. But these prosecutors in Michigan are saying over 60% in the state, including Jose, fit that description. This position is in step with the state's attorney general, who fought against resentencing, saying it would unnecessarily re-traumatize the victims' families. It's hard to know where the Kaji family stands now. They did not respond to multiple requests for an interview. But Eamon Kaji, who remains paralyzed from the neck down, is quoted in a Detroit Free Press article. He said during the getaway driver's trial over 20 years ago, quote, "I'm a Christian, but I'll never forgive," end quote.
I would like to say to the family that I am truly, truly, truly sorry for what happened that night. I had no right to be there. I had no right to have a weapon. I had no right to shoot. You know, nobody gave me no right to take a life. And that is something that I live with on a daily basis. It's something that I think about all the time.
You know, it's probably maybe a complicated and a basic question at the same time, but do you think that you deserve a second chance, that you deserve to get out of prison?
I think I do. I know without a shadow of a doubt that I am not the person I used to be. I carry myself now, and I live a life now where, you know, I don't define myself for what happened that night. I did have to be held responsible or accountable for what took place that night. But to say that I'm deserving of a life without parole sentence, of never being able to just know what life is outside of prison, I don't feel that I deserve that type of sentence.
For people, you know, some people look at it and say, you know, a life for a life. Why do you think it's fair for you to get out when one of the Kajis was killed and another one is paralyzed?
I guess I wouldn't compare it to it being fair. I'm not sure if that's how I would describe it. It is difficult to say, well, you know, I want my freedom, when in fact you're correct. There's a person who lost a life. You know, I don't forget that. I don't want nobody to ever think that the victims get lost in our pursuit for freedom. I've had so many different conversations with other juvenile lifers, and we do not forget that on the other side of this is also a victim. So there's a balance there. There's a balance there where, you know, we do want to be free. You know, I want to be free. I want to be able to go out there and live my life, but there is a life that was tied to that, and there's no separating the two. The only thing I can do is go out there and be the best man that I can possibly be.
Jose says he believes a second chance is an opportunity for juvenile lifers to make a difference in communities they already took so much from. It's also an opportunity for him to do better by his family, particularly his grandmother.
She always tells me that she has a dream that, you know, one day she'll get up and, you know, there'll be a knocking at the door and it'll be me, you know. So I do the best I can to see to it that happens, you know. That's another thing that you know, my grandmother, you know, I want to get out and make her proud.
Do you feel like you disappointed her?
excuse me. I hope not. I mean, I know she wanted more for me. But I know that's, you know, another thing that drives me, just to become something that she can be proud of. Yep. Sorry about that.
There's this tricky dance with hope and fear right now for Jose and his family. The legal system is moving slowly. Jose is still waiting for his resentencing court date to be scheduled, and he knows full well when that date comes, he might leave court with the same sentence he arrived with, life without the possibility of parole. For Stateside, I'm Morgan Springer.
That story is part of Interlochen Public Radio's series Irredeemable about Michigan juvenile lifers. You can listen to more stories from this series by going to irredeemable.org.